Power boom boom boom, power boom boom, power boom boom boom, power boom boom, power boom boom boom, power boom boom.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 Madison. Listener sponsored community radio.
The People's Station.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice!
No peace! No, I say you've been misled. You've been had. You've been took.
Good morning, Madison.
Okay.
Good morning, Madison. Welcome to Tuesday 8 o'clock Buzz. I'm your host, Demeter Brown. Happy Tuesday morning. And I think we all have some reason to celebrate this morning. Yesterday, the Madison School District, the school board voted to unanimously end police in schools. We now have police-free schools. And that's an amazing accomplishment for Madison. I think it's an amazing accomplishment for the youth squad of Freedom Inc., who has been showing up to those meetings week after week after week for years. It's just an indication of what hard work and sticking to it can do. And Freedom Inc. has been an amazing leader in this in the community, as well as other organizations. I know Urban Triage had something to do with that as well. And all of the leadership that we're getting out of the Black community is tremendous around this. So congratulations to those people who made this happen and who brought us together to stand with them and do this work. So thank you, Inc. Thank you, Scott. Today, we are going to be talking to some folks from Time Bank, the restorative justice team there, and other people from Time Bank who have been working on that, and see what they think about restorative justice in police schools. Also be talking to Carl Locher, who is one of the organizers for the Democratic Socialists of America here in Madison. And he's gonna talk to us about their mission, what they're doing right now, And that should be really exciting. So stay with us. We'll be right back after we take this short music break, and then we'll be talking to Carl Locher. Good morning. We're here with Carl Locher from Democratic Socialists of America. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm doing well this morning. How are you?
I'm good. I was really happy about the weather. It's pretty nice out there right now. So you are the co-chair of, I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just about to say you are the co-chair of the Electoral Politics Working Group for the Madison Area Democratic Socialists of America. What a mouthful. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah. So the Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, and it's organized largely around chapters in local areas. So Madison has a chapter here, and each chapter really takes on work that is identified by its members and its community. Here in Madison, we operate around having different groups take on different kinds of campaigns and different kinds of political action. And so the Electoral Politics Working Group, as you said, quite a long name to get to the fact that we're a group of activists within the Madison Area Democratic Socialists of America that are working to kind of build socialism from electoral politics and to help elevate the work of people, elected officials, people who are running campaigns who are running as socialists, and to make it something that's a serious consideration in our community's politics.
The most popular person that you guys have helped get elected recently is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing victory because, I mean, especially when we look at how she's been doing. But you guys also that same year got, I think, 13 other candidates elected. Isn't that true?
Yeah. And it I think in 2019 was a really active year. In 2020, supporting re-election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and many other people across the country. Here in Madison, we've been taking steps towards supporting a number of officials who are now in office. We started with our first endorsement last year of Ananda Murillo, who's now on the school board. This past spring, we endorsed a number of people for county board and city council, and currently we're working to support Nada El-Mikashvi's campaign for District 26 of State Senate.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Bowman in New York, too. I just have to mention that was another upset of a 30-year incumbent that he defeated in the primary. That was also amazing. The other thing I think about, too, well, so Ilhan Omar was also Democratic mm-hmm. Socialist, right? Yep, okay, mm-hmm. so many. Yep. Well, excellent work. So when I think about DSA, I think about Michael Harrington back in like the early 70s and how that the radicalism of DSA back then, it seems like they were really affiliated with like the labor movement and mm-hmm. Less with the Democratic Party. Do you think that there's a shift in your platform or your approach, or what are the differences between now and when you guys started?
Oh, gosh. I feel like I think that depends on the perspective you come from in some ways. I think the ins and outs of socialist politics between all the different groups that have existed in the United States over the last 100 years is can get pretty complicated. And so I think there are a lot of shifts. I think the big shift is that there are a lot more people involved in DSA now than there ever has been in the past. And a lot of the activism that happens within DSA is driven by the members in it. What that means is that we're certainly very much aligned with the labor movement, but also very much aligned with rank and file labor movements and working to support the activism within communities. And often that's, I think, more radical or a little further to the left than it was even in Michael Harrington's time. So we've seen a number of, to stick with the theme of labor, DSA chapters and DSA nationally supporting kind of insurgent campaigns within unions to elevate the rank and file and have more democratic unions. A lot of the teacher strikes that we saw in the last couple of years were supported by union activists who learned about that organizing through organizing with other DSA members.
Yeah, but I also heard that a lot of those teacher strikes were wildcat strikes and they didn't have the support of their unions.
Right, right. And so I think that might be, I suppose, the difference I'm trying to go with is that certainly supporting organized labor is a huge part of what we do, but sometimes I think what that meant in the past was aligning with the leadership of unions and a top-down approach, and we're seeing DSA members working with kind of a bottom-up approach more often these days.
I think that's very, very, very needed, and I understand that distinction now. And also, like, I think you guys endorsed Sanders both times he ran, mm-hmm. and but now that Sanders is out and the whole push to get the right kind of electoral response, are you guys doing stuff around voter suppression? And, you know, we've been seeing some really horrific examples of it. What are you guys doing? What's your work like that on that look like?
Yeah, I can't speak to what might be happening nationally there. It's certainly we just learned that there's a new wave of this happening in Wisconsin, as I believe a court decision happened recently that's going to prevent some access to early voting. I think the difficulty is when we talk about what we can do as a grassroots organization for combating voter suppression is that the wave of voter suppression is coming from people with a lot more lawyers and a lot more money than an organization like us has. What we are trying to do is make sure there's accurate information in the hands of people who are going to vote so that they know how they can and they have as best as available the resources available to them to actually vote, which we found was in the spring nonpartisan election was incredibly difficult. That was changing practically by the day as to how you might be able to vote. And so I can imagine that being a challenge coming into certainly the August primary that we're going to come up to in August 11th and probably even November as the pandemic continues, maintaining access to actual information about how you can vote is going to be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, so do you have people, are there organizations in this community that you are collaborating with around the work you do, or are you guys, do you work alone?
We, you know, I think for electoral politics, we are probably a little bit more on our own, but we, with a lot of the campaigns and activism that DSA, Madison DSA does, we work with other organizations all the time. And to pick up on the thread of labor work, we were really active in supporting the union organizing effort in the Willie Street Co-op. And we have a lot of our members are part of labor groups throughout the city. We also have been turning out to support Black-led organizing, particularly around the No Cops in Schools campaign over the last couple of years. And so I think a lot of what we try and do is also be there and turn out to the work that other people are organizing.
Well, that's amazing. We're here with Carl Locher from Democratic Socialists of America. And Carl, we only have a few minutes left, but I just wanted to see if there are other things that are coming up for you guys that you're working on that you want to share, and if you want to tell people how to get in touch with you and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that's coming up for us in the immediate future is that we've got a panel coming up this evening with elected officials who Madison DSA has endorsed, and so we're going to have Ananda Murilli, Max Prestigiacomo from the City Council, and Heidi Wegleitner from Dane County Board. They'll be joining us, as well as yourself, Dr. Tamita Brown, thank you, and Bianca Gomez from Freedom Inc. to talk about what can happen going forward with efforts to defund police and abolish prisons in our community. And I think building on the success that we've just seen with Freedom Inc.'s No Cops in Schools campaign. So that panel is this evening. On our meeting that'll happen over Zoom at 7 p.m. this evening, you can go to madison.dsausa.org to find that event and register for the event. But you can also find more of our work there and email us through the website.
Well, thank you so much. That's really amazing work that DSA is doing. It's much needed. Whenever I think about DSA, I just say, I hope they're bringing the Democratic Party further and further towards the left so that we can kind of break out of some of the craziness that is a two-party system. And, you know, we need more than two parties. You know, I would love it if you guys just broke out on your own. And because I always think of you guys as aligned within, I feel like I'm starting another conversation, sorry, and we're at the end, so, but yes, I want to talk about what it means to, like, break away from the two-party system at some point. Will you come back and talk to us about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Well, I so appreciate you, Carl. You have a great day, and we'll see you later.
All right, thank you so much.
We are back, Madison. Thank you so much. This is 2 to 8 o'clock Buzz. We are here with the Dane County Time Bank staff, and they're here to talk about what it means with the victory that we achieved last night with the school board voting for police-free schools. Welcome, Dane County Time Bank staff.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, you guys. So we have Ryan Eichel, who is the transportation and exchange coordinator. We have Lori Herkes-Dwyer, who is the executive director, and we have Araceli, who is a communications coordinator. And thank you all for being here. You do so much to make sure that, you know, Time Bank is doing what it needs to do to help the community. Lori, would you start out by talking about, give us an overview of what Time Bank does and something about its restorative justice work?
Sure, yeah. So the Time Bank is a member group. It's an exchange network where people contribute and support each other within the community. And so the Time Bank has been doing restorative justice work since 2006. And so through our restorative justice work, we're doing processes both in the schools and in the community to work through different situations that are happening.
That's great. So right now we're living through probably what I would say is pretty historic. The police have been in Madison schools since the 90s, the early 90s, mm-hmm. and now they're not, as of mm-hmm. yesterday. What do you guys attribute that to? Like, coming to this moment in time, what were the situations and the work and the, you know, the kinds of organizing that led to this change? Talk about how that's been coming down in the Madison community.
Sure. Well, I mean, I feel that Freedom Inc. and the Freedom Inc. Youth Squad, first of all, have been organizing and mm-hmm. communicating and going to school board meetings and doing a huge Police Free Schools campaign for the past, I don't know, 5 years or so. So this issue around police being in schools is an issue that has come up multiple times over the past many years. And mm-hmm. so, you know, and so there's been tons of work that has happened in the community, and there's been tons of support for Police Free Schools for a long time as well, definitely led by Freedom Inc. and the Youth Squad and other community members. And so,
another movement, too.
Yeah.
Let's not forget Young, Gifted, and Black. I said, let's
for
not
sure.
forget the Young, Gifted, and Black movement that started in 2014.
For sure.
And through that, because of Tony Robinson's murder there in East High School, just mm-hmm. being that leader and that kind of the first call there that happened, I think that's where the youth became mobilized. That's when they became organized. And that's the thing about this movement is, like, really it's about the kids. They were the ones who decided it. They took over. You know, you tell them that this is their school over and over again. We tell them this is their school, but yet we don't give them the tools to make it their school. And I think that's mm-hmm. where it came to for the kids. Like, they're just done. I'm done. And mm-hmm. so I really they're done, and they took it over, and that's great. And this is, even though I've heard of what was all said last night, that this was the decision of the board, you know, don't dispower the fact that those kids took they go to that school board meeting for so many years, you know what I'm saying? Like, over to Doyle Building, it is not an easy time to have a school board meeting at 6 o'clock when you're hungry. You know, it's like 6 o'clock in the afternoon, that's dinner time. And these kids, instead of doing homework, were there every month for the school board meeting. You know, they experienced ridicule from some of the board members not being able to pronounce their names correctly, to just, hello, I'm hungry. You know, it's 6 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. and I'm, instead of doing, you know, schoolwork, I'm here demonstrating, speaking out on what I want for my school. And so it took a lot of leadership, mm-hmm. a lot of individually. I wanted to just acknowledge the spirit of the students individually who went there on a regular basis as a parent of color and a homeowner and taxpayer to the Madison School District and a graduate. I can just say that I'm so excited. I'm so pleased to see this. To see this youth activism, and it's not, to me, surprising that it came from a big push from the student, from Madison School District students, because that's the thing. The Madison School District cultivates these very passionate students of color, right? They're very passionate students of color. They're dedicated students of color because we have instilled in them self-confidence. And for the ones who actually believe that narrative, right, and so the narrative that's, you know, sometimes portrayed in Madison streets, they actually believe that narrative and they feel empowered and they believe in that. So I give them that, this torch, because of the sacrifices they've done since like 2014 and if not beyond.
And Araceli, I wanna touch on a point that you made also about the fact that you drove this change. And I think that another part of that is the fact that we could easily have not supported their leadership over the last several weeks since the murder of George Floyd. They have been making their voices heard around the violence that the Black community faces as in general. And, you know, we could easily have not supported their leadership and what youth were doing in these last several weeks. And that could have been a point of division, but we had the clear sight and vision of Black leaders in the community who said, we will not be divided, and they stood behind their youth. And I think that that is a beautiful and transformative moment for us as a community to make sure that that happened, and we need to make sure that continues to happen. Ryan, did you want to comment on any of these recent changes with the school board vote? How are you feeling this morning, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm feeling you know, it's a great, I mean, it's so moving to hear the news and to know that something that the youth and Freedom Inc. and activists have been working on for so many years, like, I have immense gratitude for the work that they all did so that this can happen, and I believe it's you know, something that schools and youth really need is this change. And I think I was just kind of thinking about how, you know, those years that, as Araceli was describing, years where youth coming to the school board meetings were disrespected or not listened to, I think it's amazing how the kinds of viewpoints that are seen as too radical to even be like considered or like give time to, when simply it was just youth expressing what their needs are and what they need to see in their environment. It really just takes keep showing up, and the more people speak out, there comes an instance and a moment in history where people start to realize where that radical idea transforms into common sense, because they do see the urgent need finally. But without that dedication from the youth, that couldn't have happened. So, like I said, immense gratitude for them.
Yeah, I love the phrase radical push turns into common sense. And it seems like that's what we have arrived at here with this most recent vote. And I'm also thinking in terms of, like, you know, the police are probably the most glaring example of, you know, like, criminal justice run amok and the kind of violence our kids are dealing with in a day-to-day basis doesn't go away just because the police are out of the school building now. And so we really need to be thinking, like, as restorative justice advocates and practitioners, you know, how does that transition and how does that work continue to make sure that all of the different aspects of violence that Black and brown people face, whether it's in the school building or in the rest of the community, but particularly in schools, well, how do we continue to make that transition away from violence and towards the kind of community that we actually need for for yeah. people to thrive, for Black people to thrive. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, Lori, could you talk about the definition of restorative justice, just and just, you know, to contextualize that definition for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. I mean, restorative justice is it's about community. It's a community-based approach that really recognizes the value and the worth of the people that are involved in the dialogue, and it really focuses on, it attempts to shift power dynamics so that people can really walk into the conversation feeling grounded, feeling supported, feeling celebrated, and then also everybody that's linked to it takes responsibility for their part in it, takes accountability for their part in it, and helps to repair the situation and so that everybody can move forward.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the obstacles that I know I've listened to our coordinators talk about, some of the challenges that they face in doing their work in the high schools, and it is right. I mean, it does have a lot to do with, like, that accountability and that kind of sense of everybody taking responsibility for their role, that's still a big push. Like, that to get that kind of 360-degree accountability is still a challenge. And I think that may be related to the fact that, you know, RJ in the schools here is still in its implementation phase. Like, there's still so much work that needs to be done to make that happen, to make that a real culture shift for our schools. What do you think needs to happen in order to move that work forward or to expedite that work in terms of making sure all the schools have what they need to do that work? Mm. I know that's a tough question, and it's not one you can answer alone, but just give me some of your impressions of where you'd like to see the work develop.
I mean, for me, I think some of it is definitely linked to, for example, some of the other demands associated with police-free schools, being like for community to have more control over school discipline types of processes, or for community to have more input in how things are responded to. You know, I think that's there's a big piece of that that's missing that needs to be there in terms of who decides what happens when and things like that. And those, you know, those actions tend to be punitive, because punitive is faster and punitive is just immediate. And I think that we need to move beyond that for sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of my favorite things actually about restorative justice. And I know for the work that I do, I use the term abolitionist restorative justice. But my favorite thing about it is that it's not just trying to make something go away. Mm-hmm. It's trying to get us deeper into what's actually going on. And the focus isn't, it's not like, here's a quick fix. It's like, what is the time and energy needed to put into building community that makes people feel that they are worthy and belong, and helps us all understand our interconnections, so that we feel a sense of responsibility to that community, and that community feels a sense of responsibility to us. And that's a very loving and gentle way to deal with human beings. You know,
I think we used to have some of that. I mean, I'm not going to say it was ever perfect, but I think before we had a little bit of more of that when we had possibly more teachers around, more SEA, just like staff there too. I think that the result too of like leaning on the police was because of like cuts and like, oh, now it's more students per, you know, per teacher. And more students that are lacking, you know, that don't have all the skills, you know, school readiness skills that they needed by the age of 5. I mean, it's a long thing, and it starts at like age 3. It starts at age 3, and I don't mean to chime in, but just as like a former substitute teacher for so many years. I mean, seeing it from the inside too, just like it's overwhelming. And I think there's a lot to, what you were saying about punitive, I think it became like such a, like a knee jerk reaction to not having the right resources already and losing some of that community responsibility and leniency. And maybe we never had it. Maybe that's just some sort of nostalgic thing that I think about, but at the same time, felt that before there was a little bit more like community support versus just like pointing the finger of like, oh my gosh, there was this, they're doing this bad. And it's like all of that negativity, like it just, what was not going to happen, you know, all of that negativity and like that, you know, the kids obviously internalized it. They started it, you know, it's just a lot of negativity that starts, you know, cycling through that, through the school, and there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. So when I think about restorative justice, it's like healing as well, repairing that harm, but even the structure of like that it's a crime to like, it's so difficult because inside of the school, is that really a crime? So there's always that structural component, I think, of like defining these words too, and that sometimes what ended up happening, I saw at least, was that school leadership just started like really criminalizing all of these actions that previously I don't think they didn't warrant that, or maybe they hadn't interacted with it, so it was beyond of their understanding of how to utilize principles of restorative justice. So I think that needs to be really fundamentally taught throughout schools do you see what I'm saying? Like, not to see one behavior as like all of a sudden, like, oh, that's like, you got to have other language than just criminalized language. And that,
well, one of the things that I would say about that, Arnfeld, is that when I was a kid, which is back in the Stone Ages, the disproportionate disciplining of Black children was going on then too. And that's like 40 years ago. So
exactly.
It's not really just the changes in class sizes, it's that the inherent structural racism in our public school system. And so the disparities that we're looking at in Dane County are some of the worst in the world, in the United States. But and that is not new. It is something that has been going on for a very long time. And so I think that some of the structural issues that restorative justice can address, we need to continue to focus on that and to bring that out and make it more visible. There are a lot, some of the dynamics you point to do impact, they very much impact the quality of the environment for all students. The class size is an issue. But I think that more so when we're looking at punitive discipline, how it's been disproportionately used against Black children is the central issue in a lot of ways for this. The situation we're looking at right now, and like in the continuing push to like make sure that culture changes, is I think right
it's
in the wheelhouse where restorative justice can do some great work.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess another question, you know, is like, so right now everything is fresh and new, and we don't know what they're going to come up with in terms of like if they are taking funds away from the those roles that the police had and putting them into other stuff. I think, Lori, you were starting to talk about redirecting that funding towards, you know, some of the other needs in the community.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty important. So is there more that you would say about that and, like, what you would like to see? And please, others, Ryan and Araceli, as far as where you see the needs, the restorative needs in our schools, please chime in as well. And I love the way, actually, Araceli, I just want to say, it's great that you feel free to jump in. That's awesome. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that money should definitely, for sure, be redirected into things that support Black youth, things that are culturally relevant to Black youth, art, creative opportunity, anything that is needed. I mean, there's, you know, when talking with some of our coordinators about engagement in school and who the school looks at and feels that they're engaged and who feels that they're not, and why is that happening, and why don't we invest that money into shifting some things around so that it's more so people want to be there more, you know, there's a that people see themselves reflected in that space, so people feel comfortable in that space, they don't feel judged or watched or targeted. Put the money into things that rebuild those pieces. You know, what do you expect in an environment like that? I mean, it's a toxic environment.
So one of the things that I think it would be helpful to get into a little bit more is sort of a history of Time Bank. Not so much the history as what is it and how does it work. It's like, I'm imagining that there are listeners out there who don't know enough about Time Bank and want to know more and how to get involved in some of the stuff. So I think I would ask Ryan to talk a little bit about Transformative Action Network stuff people can get into. But then if Lori, if you could just first tell us more about how Time Bank works.
Sure. So there's Time Banks all over the world, and there's Time Banks all over the U.S. And the idea of a Time Bank is really simple. Individuals or organizations can join up, and then they exchange time with each other. So for every amount of time that you're doing something to support your community or support another person in whatever way, or share your skills or share your experience or whatever, you earn that amount of time as a credit that you then can access things from within the network. So it's a way to, within a group or a community, see what requests folks have and see what offers folks have, and have community support and community working to meet each other's needs.
Oh, I was muted. Sorry. I was just talking about the mask giveaway and how people who sewed masks for that earned Time Bank hours.
Right. Right. So for that, example, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, is there another example that comes to mind that you wanted to share?
I mean, another example is, like, for example, the Food Justice Project, where people are working on the farm and they're earning hours for the time that they're on the farm, and then they can get a box of produce, or they can get a box of produce and give it to you, give it to someone else who needs that produce.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then the Transformative Action Network projects, Ryan, can you talk a little bit about those?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So Transformative Action Network is a project within the Time Bank, started by Demita and a lot of Time Bank members, but also people from Freedom Inc. and other people in the community have gotten involved, and it's a group of people committed to co-conspirator abolitionist anti-racist action. And I kind of see it, you know, as we're talking about restorative justice and its futures and ways of.
Hey, Ryan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ryan. We have 2 minutes left. Can you just list a few of the projects that we're working on? And then I really am so sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure people know about a few of those.
Yes, that's important. So we have a lot of different projects going on. One is our letter writing campaign to end violence against Black people. We help people learn about how to write letters to different institutions and with our demands. Our next session for that is July 2nd at 7 p.m., and it occurs every other Thursday. We also have upcoming training, such as our abolitionist restorative justice training on July 8th, and we have Community Lab for Intentional Practice every third Monday at 2:30, and our Restorative Anti-Racism Circle every fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. So lots of opportunities for self-reflection and also anti-racist action.
That was a wonderful, wonderful wrap-up. Thanks, Ryan. So I know that we're out of time, but people can go to the Dane County Time Bank website and hear more about what Ryan was talking about. and see how exchanges work. You can call us and talk to any of us about what that looks like. Right now, I want to thank my guests, Araceli Esparza, Ryan Eichholz, and Lori Herkes-Wire for giving me part of your precious morning to come in here and talk about what matters to you around this work. And so thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Right now, I just want to say to listeners, thank you for being here. And my name is Demita Brown. You've been listening to the Tuesday 8 o'clock Buzz on your community-sponsored station, WORT Madison. Coming up next, we have another Green Morning, and we'll see you guys next week.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 Madison. Listener sponsored community radio.
All power to the people!